Alium stands in solidarity with emergency physicians and learners in denouncing the structural racism and acts of violence that disproportionately affect persons of color. We denounce the senseless death of George Floyd, which adds to the ever-rising numbers of deaths among Black men and women. The dissemination of the now viral video documenting Mr. Floyd's last desperate moments has brought a renewed public awareness to a disease that has, for far too long, afflicted this nation. We see the injustice and disparities in healthcare that are made even more visible during the COVID-19 pandemic. Alium is committed to taking action against racism and discrimination and joins the American College of Emergency Physicians, the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine, and the American Academy of Emergency Medicine in urging frontline healthcare providers, educators, and leaders to promote a safe, equitable, and inclusive learning and patient care environment in emergency medicine. We support diversity and free and open access to medical education and uphold efforts to embrace our common humanity.
Welcome to Emergency Medicine Match Advice, sponsored by your friends at Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, and its editor-in-chief, author of the new book, Trick of the Trade, Dr. Michelle Lin from the University of California, San Francisco. Hello, Michelle.
Hello. That's so heartwarming to hear. I just don't actually have the book in my possession, but hey, I'm taking the title anyway, right now, book author.
There you go. Newly published author. Congrats on the new book.
Thank you.
This has been a longstanding labor of love, and we've done maybe several dozen of these episodes over the years. We're now in like season six and a half. And think of all the residency programs and fellowship programs that have plugged their program on our show. But this is the first time I get to throw it to you to plug your new book. So I thought I'd catch you off guard
for a minute or two.
And just tell us a little bit about the book and where our potential readers can order one.
What are you doing? This is crazy.
I know.
We were trying to be all stealthy and just like release it and have an organic growth from there. But it's been like a 5-year process, painstakingly self-published outside of a publisher besides ourselves. Because we feel like that's true to our core nature of we don't need the middle people. Well, how can we reinvent education and publish things the way we want them to be published and have full creative autonomy? And so it was a struggle because this is not my wheelhouse. But, you know, we summarized the 50 top tricks of the trade out there and put it into a really crisp copy book, hardbound, full color with illustrations and photos to kind of bring up our game in education. And with so much digital out there, I find some solace in just sleeping next to a hardbound book. I don't know about you, like the pages smell great. So this is what, this is our aim. And we finally published it and you can find it on our website on Tricks of the Trade book. And if you buy it early enough, I'm happy to autograph and send you a surprise gift with it. So that's what we're doing right now.
Surprise gift.
It is. It's sitting in my kitchen.
When you say we, who's the we?
Oh, you know what? I have some amazing co-authors and that's Dr. Mary Haas, who was just the workhorse of this group. And she was like, let's work on this right now. I'm like, it's a Saturday at midnight. She's like, it's all right. We're going to work on it right now. So it's her and Dr. Brian Hayes and Dr. Nikita Joshi. So the four of us have always been a little ninja cohort, and we're excited to share all the news with you.
Well, congratulations, all you program directors out there. I think it's the perfect gift for your incoming interns. Michelle, this is just a nice time to celebrate a huge accomplishment for an already hugely accomplished educator. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right. So today's episode, Michelle, is a very special one. Our favorite annual review of the most recent match entitled EM Program Directors Reflect on the 2020 Match. Was it a competitive year? Did it get easier for students? You'll have to stay tuned to find out. And to offer their sage advice and reflections on this year's match, we have three outstanding program directors. Dr. Sean Fox from Carolinas Medical Center.
Hello, super excited to be here. Thank you. And Dr. Lin, can I just put my name down for 14 of those books? I'm going to need them all autographed, though. I appreciate it.
You got it.
See how I did that? Oh my gosh, I love it.
You're going to take a commission, I feel.
I better. I want something. Dr. Amy Stubbs from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Hello, Dr. Stubbs.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
And last but not least, Dr. Butch Humbert from Indiana University.
Hello, everyone. Great to be here as well.
All right. So, Michelle, every year we offer a quick review of the numbers. Students, I'm going to refer you to the show notes for this episode on the Alien blog site under EM Match Advice Archives. And you'll find the show notes for this episode, which will allow you to view numbers as you listen to the episode. And the numbers are on what we call annually the slide, as it has come to be known, which reviews the match data for the emergency medicine match over the last 10 years. So very quickly, it's broken down into nine columns. Column one is the year. Column two is the number of ACGME approved programs that offered entry level spots in the match this year. Once again, we see this number climbing. This year, it went to 256 programs with intern spots, up by 18. Column three is the number of positions offered by those programs. So this case, 2,665, again, an increase by 177 spots as programs, new programs come online and previously accredited programs expand in size. Column four is the number of those positions that were filled in the match. So it's a very high number, 2,652. And then that brings us to where it gets interesting. So column five is the number of positions filled by what we call LCME seniors. So these are the senior medical students from the allopathic medical schools in the US, Puerto Rico, and Canada. And the number of positions filled by the LCME seniors was 1,713. So we convert that to a percentage in column six, and it's the percent fill rate by LCME seniors, which we emphasize every year in this episode. This year it was 64.3%, again, a drop from last year, 65.8, which is something we've observed as a steady decline in the percent fill rate by the seniors since the single accreditation system or the conversion of AOA or osteopathically accredited programs to ACGME accredited programs. And as the number of programs has spiked because of this AOA to ACGME conversion, the number of corresponding LCME students perhaps did not. And the overall percentage of LCME allopathic seniors filling those spots drops. So this is our internal marker of competitiveness that we like to focus on in this show, right? It's not the fill rate. I think students often conflate this, that there are very few, if not zero spots every year at the time of the scramble or the SOAP process in the match. And therefore we say, well, emergency medicine fills every spot. It must be really competitive, but it's not really the right number, right? It's the fill rate that matters. The highly competitive specialties, such as diagnostic radiology, thoracic surgery, vascular surgery, historically, they fill with LCME seniors at fill rates approaching, if not 100%. Interestingly, that changed dramatically this year. The only sort of uber specialty program that crossed the 90% mark was plastic surgery at 91.7%, which is a really interesting trend. Now, there are a few exceptions to these numbers. There are very, very few combined programs with very few spots like psych neuro or peds anesthesia, and they filled at 100% allopathic seniors, but these are very few overall PGY1 positions. Competitive specialties, which we used to think of ourselves as maybe not uber competitive, but we were competitive, right? So we were right there with OB and surgery. They have seen their numbers drop a bit too. So general surgery was at 67.3% fill rate. When they had been up in the sort of high 70s to 80s where we used to live, the less competitive specialties, if you will, internal medicine, for instance, is at 40.2% allopathic seniors. Peds, a little bit more competitive, 60.4%. So we're still more competitive than peds in medicine. We're probably in the range of OB and surgery like we used to be. And that may be because some of those osteopathic surgery and OB positions are also coming under the ACGME accreditation. But here's where the numbers that folks really care about. So 25.6% of EM spots were filled with osteopaths and 10.1% by independent applicants. 43 of these students were allopathic grads, so they just weren't a senior, but they'd gone and done something else, the military or another residency. 28 were osteopathic grads, same sort of thing. And then 155 were international medical grads. So the final columns really quickly. Column seven is the number of unfilled positions. This year it was 13, down from 30 last year. That's still 99.5% of our positions in the match, effectively zero. Remember, the SOAP or the scramble is not a way to get into emergency medicine. There's effectively zero positions to be planned on every year. Column eight is the number of those unmatched LCME seniors. So when we think about LCME seniors, allopathic seniors only applying to emergency medicine, those that didn't match in emergency medicine, this year the number was 99. It has historically always been under 100. And column nine is that same sort of concept. You only apply to emergency medicine, you didn't match, but you are an independent applicant, so a DO or an IMG, that number always under 200. Again, once again this year, it's 133. So 75 osteopaths did not match to EM and 58 IMGs. So with that review of the numbers, let's dive into them and have a discussion of what they actually mean and put them into context. So let's get to our first panelist, Dr. Fox from Carolinas Medical Center. And, you know, I just gave you all the numbers. Give us your impression of 2020. Was it a more competitive year, less competitive, stay the same? What's your impression?
So my overall impression of this previous interview season is that it was as competitive as it has always been. I would not say that it was more or less competitive. I felt like our application process was very similar to what we had experienced in the past. Your numbers, I think, would kind of support that. While if you want to piecemeal some of the exact details of the data points out, there might be even a less competitive vibe going on there. I would say from an operation standpoint, my experience has been that we are, as we were in the previous years, strong, competitive, but it is not getting to a point where it is unwieldy and individuals that are really wrestling each other for individual spots.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, I throw a lot of data out just to sort of be provocative and to get the conversation going. But, you know, I think there's numbers and then there's the pulse on the ground. And yours is a very, I would say, well-respected, old and storied, and certainly competitive residency program. So when I say, like, yeah, there's more or less allopathic seniors, like, you guys are seeing some of the best in the country. Can you tell, right? So I could say, like, oh, there's all these extra seniors in the match. Does the quality go down, quality go up of that group itself from the allopathic schools? What's your take on that? Can you sort of tell year to year any difference?
So I'm going to be the first to admit that I am ridiculously spoiled in that I work in an amazing facility that has, as you said, some history. And that certainly allows us to sample from maybe the higher end of the spectrum. But even in that group, you know, with the thousands of applicants that we get over the past 5 years, definitely, I still see an equal number of amazing people and a nice depth and breadth of humanity in there. So the individuals that we have interviewed in our interview process, I feel have been very similar in the past several years. Now, is that across the board? Is every department, is every emergency medicine program having access to the same that I am very fortunate to have? Obviously not, but I still think that the difference that I have personally seen is that those AOA, super competitive, you're going to be able to pick where you want to go applicants. Now, instead of, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, we're interviewing on the levels of 10 to 20 places. Now we're in the 30s and 40s. And that's my concern for them, is that they don't need to be doing that. And it's potentially taking opportunities away from others. It's also stressing themselves. It might be even altering their own perception of their interactions when they're, I mean, you just can't get really good information on 30 programs if you're going to get, that's just too much travel time. I can't focus that much. So that's the big difference I've seen, is that the super competitive AOA, gold humanism, I've got every degree under my belt and every award, they're starting to ratchet up those interview numbers, and probably unnecessarily. Easy for me to say, I understand, but I would say that's probably the main difference. And that's maybe why the competitive frenzy is being felt. It's almost like people are feeling that if the gold star person who's got all the awards under the belt going into emergency medicine is interviewing at 40 places, well, I'm not that good. I better interview at 50 places. And that's my biggest concern, is that we are missing an opportunity as educators to really help direct and educate and advise, mentor our younger professionals in what their, you know, real self-assessment is.
And to be clear, you mean apply to 50 programs, right? Not interview at 50 programs.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Because then you'd be meeting some really crazy medical students. I mean, I know they're out there, but those would be a unique sample of crazy if those are the ones you're meeting.
I'm sure there's one or two. Fortunately, I haven't come across them.
Well, there you go.
No, interviewing still, I think there's probably several that are interviewing well above they should be.
Well, I mean, I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek to make the point. we've talked about this on the show many times before, the number needed to match is 11. So if you do 12, you're going to be fine, right? And anything beyond that, I think we're really causing destruction to the process overall. We're seeing, you know, these numbers of applications just go up and up and up, as you're saying. And that's part of the reason we do this episode every single year on the show. Like the numbers, students, hey, like if you listen to the last couple of years, the numbers don't change that much. And the whole point is that we're telling you that the process has not gotten that much more competitive. And I always worry, Michelle, that we're just creating more anxiety by having this topic every year. But really the take-home message is things aren't that bad.
Amen.
Amen. This is one of those triple AOA gold humanisms hosting the show. I think Michelle only interviewed at two places. Did you even apply to three? No?
I don't remember. It was so long
back
ago.
In the day, there was probably there were only three programs. Yeah, all three of the ones on this show, right, are the only three. Somehow you ended up at the fourth one. Dr. Fox, what additional advice do you have for students entering this year's match? I think COVID makes it a very unique time. We're going to spend a little bit more time on that topic in a bit. But any general advice for the students as you look to 2021?
You know, I think we need to all be appreciative of the fact that we're in kind of uncharted territory and we're all paddling together. I think there is some reassurance that we are all moving together and that you're not in it alone. Hopefully that fact will help ease some tension and allow other people to still get the good advice and the good mentorship into how many programs really they should apply to and certainly how many they should interview with. My one concern is the ability to speak so easily without traveling now. And if we're going to be interviewing and I'm doing it from my kitchen or my living room and I can easily say, well, I can probably do 25 interviews now. And I would still say, let's be reasonable and make use of your EM faculty advisors who will be able to really help guide us.
Yeah, you know, we did an episode, Sean, our last episode was on some of the things to anticipate with COVID. And I think we just had a group of really thoughtful, well-intentioned PDs just sort of shrugging their shoulders. And I think, you know, we probably have more to talk about today, and I'm excited to throw it to our next panelist for that. But, you know, as you talk about these virtual interviews, we are going to have an episode later this summer just on the virtual interview process. I think once everybody sort of has their process down and we sort of know a little bit more. So thank you very much. Let's turn to our second panelist, Dr. Amy Stubbs from UMKC. I'm really excited to hear about what's new this year. But first, I just thought I'd give you a second to respond to Sean and to some of the data and get your take on, was this a different year?
Sure. I mean, I overall agree that as far as the level of competitiveness, it was very similar. Our numbers haven't really changed appreciably over the last several years as far as numbers of applicants. I almost feel like our overall pool is improving some, though, and not so much just the metrics and the step scores and the grades, but some of these, well, I'm going to call them kids, are doing things that I wouldn't have imagined at that age. I mean, I see their applications and they've been in the Peace Corps and started a foundation, and I am somewhat amazed I matched many years ago now when I read these. So if anything, I feel like that has changed. I guess I wouldn't say that only looking at LCME graduates is a mistake by any means, but I actually feel like the quality of the osteopathic applicants we're seeing has improved a lot. So in that aspect, I actually feel like the pool has gotten more competitive, because to me, I probably some years ago maybe did view them a little differently, but anymore I really don't.
Yeah, and I've said this on past episodes too, this is not at all meant to be a reflection of the allopaths versus the osteopaths, but I think those numbers sort of drive much of the brand of competitiveness around some of the surgical subspecialties, and that's sort of why you use it as a marker. But I agree with you, the osteopaths are getting more competitive every year.
As far as in our region, as far as new medical schools and medical school spots, they're mostly osteopathic schools. So those numbers are increasing more than LCME from what we've seen. Well, what's new this year? I think probably the question is what's not going to be new and different. So I think to reassure all the students and programs out there, I don't know that any of us quite have our bearings yet on exactly what we're going to do. To reassure people, though, I do think some things won't change. For us, we probably won't be able to do a huge number more at the interviews because we won't have the resources or the people. So therefore, my hope is that we don't have double the applicants like Dr. Fox was concerned about. And I can definitely see that. COVID obviously is the biggest thing to think about, and it's going to affect every aspect from the application timeline. We already know that's going to be different. So it's going to be a little more compact.
Can you just clarify for I don't know that the audience is as clued in as us. Why?
Sure. So just with the NRNP changing their timetable a little bit, the applications won't be released, or I guess open until October 1st. So program directors will have a little bit less time to review all the applications, assuming they stick with a similar interview schedule that they have in the past. We do have a little more time to enter our rank list. However, match day is the same. So really the season is getting condensed a little bit. Another thing, just practically, we have to consider people's health because we could have people become ill, both on faculty and interviewees. So I think we're all going to have to really be flexible with our timetables and let people change if they need to. So that's something we're going to have to look at as well. You had mentioned also, one thing to consider is the SVI gone this year. There is some irony there because I think the 1 year we need more information, that is going to be gone. And I'm like most program directors, didn't use it greatly. I don't know that any of us have it around long enough to figure out what to do with it. I am glad that it's one less layer of stress for the students.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I mean, I was on the side that the SVI was something worth examining. And as a research study, it proved that there is some validity to standardizing an interview when it's done online. But all of the rest of the implementation part of that, right, the cost and scaling it up to all the students, that stuff was just never gonna work out in the way that they had originally implemented or tested in our specialty. But you're right, we learned a lot of interesting things from it, right? And now we're going to apply some of those lessons in terms of video interviewing.
Indeed. Obviously, video interviewing for all of us, I think we've all had practice now from doing other meetings and interviews online. But for some of the students, that'll be a new experience. So if anything, I'll definitely be encouraging my advisees to practice and make sure they've got good setups and see how they look on their screen and kind of go through some mock sessions, which we generally try to do in person, but this is kind of a different animal.
Yeah, I mean, this is the issue of equity, right? They came up with the SVI to begin with, right? You had some schools who could really put on a professional stage set, you know, television set for their students to go in, and others were doing it on their iPhone at the mall. Are there still malls?
Starbucks.
At the mall. Yeah, Starbucks. There you go. That's where the kids hang out. Yeah. So there's sort of an inequity, if you will, between where students went to. And now you're going to ask students to do all of their interviews potentially from their homes. And, you know, does everybody have the highest speed Wi-Fi and all the things that they need to be able to present themselves in the right way? I agree. Hey, I have a provocative question I'm going to ask all three of you. You can give me the yes, no, less than 60 seconds. So we have video interviews. Would you record these interviews so that lots of other people could see?
Oh, such a good question.
What? I know. Michelle's head just went nuts. All right, Sean, what do you think? Would you record the interviews so that your whole faculty could view a few of them later?
I'm going to go out on a branch and say no. I think that at this point, despite my significant love for tech and all things electronic, it offers too many avenues that could be problematic. And I don't know that next level of scrutiny is going to be beneficial to me and my program specifically.
And for full disclosure, listeners, I'm totally putting all three of them on the spot with this question, which is painting their faces, but making me enjoy it. So, Amy, what would you do? Would you record these interviews? Keeping in mind the SVI was recorded. You could watch as many times as you wanted with popcorn or red wine.
White wine here. But yeah, I don't see myself recording those, partially because I don't know that I would truly have the time to even go back and look. And it is, again, it's a big process that you're trying to go through. We take our notes, we look at our impressions of the overall applicant. So I don't know that going back and really zeroing in on one, oh, I can't believe they said that. I don't know that would benefit anyone.
Mitch, what do you think? Would you record?
Yeah, so Sean, I hope that branch that you're out on is a thick one, because I'm going to get out there with you.
Come on.
Definitely not in favor, yeah, of recording. How would you use those? I mean, if you send those to other faculty, I mean, if you think about it, if you have an applicant interview with three or four different people for 15 minutes each, right? That's an hour's worth of video, and you have 10 interviews on average per slot that you're doing. So I have 21 slots. So that's 210 interviews. That's a lot of time. And that's one of the reasons why I only looked at a handful of the SVIs, and it was more out of curiosity than anything else. So yeah, definitely no on the recording.
So, and this is a function of me being a spoiled brat and at a program that kind of say this, but when I interview people and the rest of the team that interviews, we kind of just say, okay, if you've got an interview here, we know you're qualified. Let's talk to you like a human. And I'm going to kind of push the rest of your data bits aside. We're just going to have a conversation. How am I going to have that conversation if I start off by saying, by the way, I'm going to record everything we say? The power differential already is uneven. And now it gets exacerbated considerably. again, I think I might be going further out on the limb, hope it don't break, but I would almost be as demonstrative as saying, we are not recording this. If you make an inappropriate statement, it's going to be between you and me. Now, that may still have consequences, just like it would have had consequences in our normal interview, but it's not going to be posted on YouTube, or like, it's just you and me talking. So please be relaxed. Let's have a normal conversation, because I want to know you as a person, because it's you that I want to add to my family here. And that's one of my main goals, is to determine if you as an applicant fit our weird family that we have in, you know, my specific place in Charlotte, North Carolina. If you aren't natural and aren't relaxed and don't have a normal conversation with me because you're worried that I'm recording everything, I'm not going to be able to discern whether you really fit my family or not.
It's all about amygdalas, right? Amygdalas talking to one another.
But Mike, I have to interject here, and I have a different limb to stand on, if that's okay, which is,
yeah.
But in general, I would caution all students that whenever you're on any digital platform, then anything could be recorded inadvertently for whatever reason. And so I think that adds a little bit of stress inherently based on the media that we're hosting this on. So it's going to be an interesting balance. I mean, no matter how much you tell people it's not going to be recorded, you still do pause a little bit.
I could reverse it and say, is there an inherent danger for us? You know,
Absolutely.
There is procedural issues with questions that we ask. Could it be actually that we step into a snare ourselves?
That's more likely.
The snare would be you find those interviewers who ask inappropriate or illegal questions and you take them off of your team. But if somebody asks a truly egregious illegal question,
that would be good.
A punishable offense by an HR.
To find that individual,
right?
Yeah.
It would be good. So, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily all bad if things are being, if the power differential was such that we put us into better behavior, 100%, that's a good thing. You know, I mean, I could be provocative. I'm not going to do this medical education research study. Someone else can. Interviews stink, right? Like, we have tons of literature that show that HR style interviews don't necessarily give a holistic review of the applicant, and they're incredibly biased. Implicit bias by the interviewer is documented over and over again. So if you did record a subset of interviews and then you trained your interviewers to have good iterator reliability is how they interview people. I agree. For this year, I mean, there's enough stress going on. The whole world is burning and crumbling right now. So let's not add to the fire. Hey, Dr. Stubbs, any other final comments about this upcoming year? We're looking at probably a wave of people over interviewing and over applying. You want to throw down some limits for students?
Yeah, and I think we may touch on this a bit more later, but COPA and CORE both came out with a consensus statement, really with some guidelines to reassure, I guess, us and students that while things are obviously going to be very different, we still need to encourage students not to over-apply. I still feel like 12 to 15 interviews should be sufficient for the average student who has done what they're supposed to do. I always tell my advisees that, yes, it's competitive to a point, but most of the students who apply do match, to kind of try to reassure them. And those numbers really shouldn't change appreciably this year. If anything, there's going to be a few more slots and, you know, maybe a few more students. But I do think that students have to keep that in mind. They still need to apply to the programs that they're interested in. Just like Dr. Fox said, there's going to be that temptation to over-apply because they can and they don't have to travel. But there's still going to be interview fatigue, regardless of if it's flying and driving or just lots of Zoom. I would still just reassure them that they need to do the same things and focus on the same things.
All right. Well, thanks. So let's turn to our final panelist who I think gets the enviable position of sort of taking it all from a 100,000-foot view and putting it all together. First, Dr. Humbert from IU, what are your general observations about the data this year, what Sean and Amy had to offer?
Yeah, and I would echo a lot of what they said in terms of the applicant pool that we saw, I felt like was very consistent with years past. The one thing I hadn't heard, and this is more from the lens of the students that I mentor at, or my faculty mentor at IU, it seemed like they had an easier time getting interviews last year. And I wonder if that's with the increased number of programs. I don't have any hard data. It's more I had fewer panic calls or panic emails in, you know, mid to late October saying, hey, I have no interview, or mid-November, I have no interviews yet. And I didn't have a lot of those this year, which I thought was a little bit of a refreshing trend. So maybe a little bit of corroboration for a little bit less competitive overall. But again, I feel like the applicant pool is still very strong.
Yeah, these numbers are so interesting, right? Are we diluting out an applicant pool by having so many more positions available and programs available? Or are the programs themselves aware of that and therefore over-interviewing? So does the number of folks that you interview each year, is it going up and up and up and up? And I think, you know, there's a lot of PDs this year who probably will over interview because they're very worried that the students are going to over interview because it's so much easier to not have to travel and do these video interviews. So if they're over interviewing, does that trickle down from the very, very competitive programs like those on this episode down to some of the other programs who are going to just have to blow up their interview season to be able to get to game of numbers?
No, definitely. I think that's certainly something I've thought about in terms of how to approach this year. We do a survey of all the applicants that would have matched with us but didn't, and all the people we matched. And we asked, one of the questions we asked them is how many programs you applied to. And this past year, it was about 15 to 16 was the average number of interviews. People that either matched with us or would have matched with us had gone on, which seems like a lot, especially when you look at the data
high.
From the AAMC. I mean, once you pass that magic number of 12, like you talked, or 11 you talked about, your incremental gain in terms of your match rate is very small. And so I tell students all the time that sort of 10 to 12 range is what you're aiming for to have a really good chance to match. I hope that that will continue to be true this year. And I think if everyone kind of keeps their wits about them and doesn't go crazy in terms of number of places to apply to, a number of interviews to go on, and number of interviews to offer, I think we should be okay, which is why I'm super excited about the consensus statement from CORD and EMRA and the AAM, RSA, all looking at that around 12 interviews with a max of 17. I think that's a very rational approach to this upcoming season.
Can you start from the beginning? Just tell us a little bit about that statement. You mentioned several of the professional society groups that co-signed it, but it just came out.
Right. This is like, I think, maybe less than a week old at this point. So COPA came out, as Dr. Stubbs had mentioned this, in terms of, you know, they were recommending kind of all virtual interviews, limited away rotations, and then shifting the time period back. So, and I believe the applications are being released on October 21st. So I think the key is going to be kind of looking at that and saying, we're going to have less time to look at people because, you know, we're going to want to try and get interviews going. You know, you have the holiday season in there and nobody likes to do interviews over the holidays, both faculty and students alike. So I think we're going to have a little bit harder time getting through applications quickly. So the EM groups took the COPA recommendations, said, yes, we think all EM programs should abide by these recommendations in terms of doing all virtual interviews and the limited visiting rotation. So basically so that each applicant would have one slow this year, probably from their home institution if they have a residency program at their school. If they don't have a residency program at their school, then that's sort of the exception for away rotations, to go to a school that has an EM program and do an away rotation so you can get a slow. I think there's a good chance there'll be a number of students that are high quality that won't have a slow. And so I hope the program directors are looking at those applications closely and considering them this year, since most of that is not due to any problem from themselves.
So let's put some words on this, right? I think what you're saying is brilliant. So it will be normal to have zero or only one slow.
Correct.
Normal. Right?
Yes,
it will be normal to not increase the number of interviews that you go on just because it's easier to do them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I like that. I like, what other things can we just agree to agree on right here?
The other thing too is I think the, you know, some of the standard things in terms of interviews is going to be the same. I know I always tell students all the time that when you have an interview scheduled and you decide you're not going to go on that interview, cancel it as soon as possible. Try and give them the program as much lead time to be able to fill that spot. With traditional travel interviews, I usually tell them less than 2 weeks. Canceling less than 2 weeks is going to kind of look bad on you. EM is a small community, so that may come back on you. With the virtual interviews, obviously, maybe that's not, the travel is not as big of an issue. So maybe a little bit less, but still trying to get those canceled as much as possible. And really only go interview at programs that you're truly interested in. If you already have 20 interviews and you get another one at some place that is you're not that interested in, then don't take it. Let someone else have that.
Are there any changes that you anticipate making at IU this year with the process? Let's take, you probably had students come in nice blue or gray suits to interview.
Yeah.
You can make them wear a suit on camera. I mean, you hardly have any clothes on right now, as far as I can see on the Zoom. So what are you going to expect from
that? Well, that's a great question. You know, it's one of those things that I haven't even thought about, to be honest with you yet. I generally don't wear a suit for the interview, so I certainly won't be wearing a suit for the interviews. I might get more dressed up than the t-shirt that I'm in right now. You know, it's interesting because it really is going to be a different animal from anything that we've ever done before. I liken this to, you know, kind of trying to build the plane as we're flying it. I mean, the application interview season, the recruitment season, so to speak, has already started. I mean, students are looking at programs to try and apply to them. We're all kind of trying to figure out how to do this as we go with a lot of uncertainty in terms of how things are going to go. So I think just be patient with each other and the programs and students, and we'll get through it together.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was poking fun a little bit, but some of the traditional norms, cancel early, don't go into too many interviews, those are still there. Some of the traditional norms will be gone, right? I mean, I think some of the things that just were inherent in face-to-face interviews. And then ultimately, and Michelle, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Ultimately, this is a year of data loss in many ways. We're going to have a little bit less emphasis on away rotations and slows. And I actually think that's a healthy, good thing. And I hope our specialty continues to endorse it post-pandemic. But also the students aren't going to get to take a tour of the ICU, and they're not going to get to take a tour of the cafeteria. And perhaps we could argue those things were not pieces of data that were important either. But so it's a year of data loss and how people make decisions. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of what I was thinking. But I think it runs both ways. I think it's data loss for the program directors and not really getting a flavor of the person over the course of a day as they're eating bagels with you in the morning. And vice versa, the student doesn't have the feel of the walls and the screaming from the EDs on the tours and the different foods that are available. Just all the intangibles, I think, are lost. But you're right, maybe that's a good thing. And maybe we really search for what really is meaningful about why they want to go to their program. And is there a different way during this crisis to find the opportunity to find that information? Like, what exactly do you want in a program? How do we get that information? And for me, my little crystal ball I have here in my study, and maybe the burden should maybe fall a little bit more on the applicant is what I'm thinking, is go back to the alumni from their medical school and say, gosh, I've been to Sean Fox's program and I know some people that maybe I should reach out and really have a heart-to-heart about what it is like being a resident in that program. That's kind of my thought. I think this is really an opportunity for students to get to know programs and to be a lot more proactive about, one, who they are and what they want, and two, harnessing the resources and networks that they have to kind of find out what programs are all about on their own. I'm curious what you guys think. Like, what's in your crystal ball? Because for me, the message I'm hearing from a lot of different consensus and groups and hangouts is that don't worry, we're all in the same boat. And I don't think that's terribly reassuring for students. It's true. It's not that reassuring. And so I'm trying to think of like positives. What can we leave them with? And for me, two things. If we're really going to be interviewing on Zoom, which I feel like is going to be a fact, is, you know, work on your virtual background. Up your game, unfortunately. And two, which is something I'm always still working on, is, you know, look at the camera and try not to look at the screen. The eye contact, I think, builds a lot of rapport, artificially so. But there's a lot of ways to game the Zoom system, and I encourage you to look into that for interview season. Maybe I can punt it to Sean.
I'll take the punt. I love what you just said, but I would take it in a little different direction. I can teach you in 5 minutes how to game the Zoom system. We can make your background better. We can make your stylistics pop. We can, you know, also make sure you got a good mic, you know, but that's honestly window dressing. That doesn't help me know who you are. But I look at this as an opportunity. If you are able to really zoom into any part of the country and interview at your heart's content, great, but do so with purpose. Don't interview and have no idea about that program. Make sure you've done your homework. And in doing so, you'll have actually explored your own desires, what it is that it is you think your next 10 years are gonna have. I know that's an unrealistic expectation for someone to think that far down the road, but where do you wanna go? How are you gonna get there? And is this program the program that's going to help you do so? It always kind of hurt my soul when I would interview people and you're interviewing at Carolinas. I have a handful of people that have done some really remarkable things from Carolinas. And I don't think you need to know everything about the place, but you should know something about the place. And are you just interviewing with us because that's a good place to interview, or that you heard that they've got really good beer pubs? Okay, great. Do your homework. Make sure you have, in doing your homework, invested the time in soul searching. And I think the fact that you aren't going to be investing the time in going to airports and parking your car, and now you can invest that time that's found into really doing some nice homework.
There is so much to unpack there, including Sean's heart, beer pubs. This issue of professionalism, I was being a little funny there, but I will come back to like Michelle's comment. Having your digital game on is almost like having a nice suit on. To me, it is a little bit about professionalism. We're in a tech age. And if I hope that we don't all get on and do all the fumbling we've been doing in every Zoom meeting that we're participating in. Like, oh my gosh, I don't know how to share my screen. And we all make a joke about it and everybody's muted. Like, oh, learn how to use a computer. So these students are going to know how to do that, right? And if they didn't wear a nice suit, we'd give them a hell for that on interview day. So I hear what you're saying. I don't know how to answer the question I'm posing to my own self here, but I think it has downstream effects. Amy, what do you think about Michelle's question?
I mean, I think it is true. It's a fact of life that we are living in a digital age. And I look at if they don't prepare for the interview, like Sean said, this is part of the preparation, is kind of heaven. And I certainly would never judge anybody if they didn't have the fanciest electronic equipment or a fancy background, because I clearly don't. But again, just being prepared and able to roll with the punches a bit is important. But I do think the substance is going to be more important because we, like you said, it's going to be a data poor interview season. We're not going to have as many numbers. We're not going to have as many letters. For our interviews, I'm going to instruct my team to really, sometimes it ends up just being a chit chat session, but I think we're really going to need to dig a little deeper with our questions this year and try to get a better sense of that person and what they're going to be like as a fit.
You know, Sean does bring up a really good point about the knowing your program you're going to interview at, and certainly you're getting at that as well. You can do a lot of homework online, but gosh, I worry about the intangible stuff that Sean talks about. You don't, that stuff happens in in-person interviews. It happens to the student who gets to go to those famous Charlotte beer pubs and hang out with the residents at night. You know, you're not going to get to do that. I mean, I'll say my personal story, I had never been west of the Mississippi before interview season. And look where I live now and where I train. I don't know, would that have happened if it was all virtual? Are people going to be able to take risks to move to cities that are sight unseen?
I agree.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I'm scared of. I think you and I and the applicants will learn how to have a conversation in this mode. And I think we'll become quite facile at it. My bigger concern is that I think it's very challenging for people to learn a culture. Anyone who comes to my institution comes here primarily not because of me, but because of my residents. And they got to hang out with them the night before the interview, and they got to see who they are. They got to enjoy their camaraderie. They got to realize that, hey, the applicants aren't the reason the residents are here at the dinner. It's because they want to hang out with the residents. And then it just so happens to be that there's applicants there. So seeing that camaraderie, seeing that culture, seeing that, how do you convey that in this media? I think that's going to be what I'm most concerned about. That's my biggest fear.
Michelle, do you want to repeat your question for Butch so he can answer?
Yeah, that's totally forgot, because I'm enamored by all of your,
I know,
responses.
Right? I feel like it's meandered
a bit. Let's go on that tangent. Let's go there.
Yeah, exactly.
All these limbs are growing out from this tree. No, my question was just like thinking about crystal ball of what's a positive, tangible take home that you can give students moving forward, given all of the uncertainty out there.
Sure. So this is when I get my crystal ball out for this upcoming season, I'm still struggling to find all the positives. And I'm sure there's some. Just to build on what Sean said there briefly, you know, I tell students all the time, you know, a big part of finding your match is that sort of gut feeling that you have. You're at the facility, you're with the people, and you're sort of, you know, you're like, I can see myself training with these folks. And I think that's going to be more challenging to do this year. So I think networking is going to be vital. And you kind of mentioned it earlier, you know, talking to alumni from your school that have done residency training there. If there's current residents from your school there at a program you're interested in, make sure you reach out to them individually and sort of outside of the interview day, get more information. The more networking you can do, the better. Finding people who have similar interests to you at that program to see what it's like to be a medical education researcher. You know, maybe you're interested in podcasts and, you know, hey, does somebody do podcasts there? Let me talk to them to get a better idea of those things. Those are the things you pick up in those informal conversations that I think we're going to have to be more proactive and more creative about.
All right, Michelle, any final observations? What do you think? What's your crystal ball say?
It's a whole new ball game out there. The rules are changed, but yet so much is unchanged, as you have reviewed based on the data. I look forward to it. I really, really do think there's an opportunity that we can try to reinvent this whole process, keep what is really good about this moving forward. And I'm glad we're doing these podcasts, because just sharing that all of the program directors here have of a similar mindset about this moving forward is reassuring. So students, I think they got your back moving forward. I know there's a lot of uncertainty, but I trust this group.
Yeah, these are the leaders of some old and storied programs that have been around the block and they know how to do this right. And to that end, let's move on with maybe Michelle's favorite part of these episodes.
It is.
Tell me something I don't know about your program plug. So give me 60 seconds and tell me something I don't know about Carolina's Medical Center, Dr. Fox.
Let's go with that. Despite our heritage, despite our 44 years in existence, we never rest on our laurels here in Charlotte. We work hard every day to try to improve our program and look for interesting ways to continue to support our young physicians in developing their culture and encouraging them to have the courage to care for all, regardless of where they are. Every day we strive to get better.
All right. I love it. Well, students, it is an old and storied and wonderful program. I remember fondly my interview day at Carolina's Medical Center. So check out the Kings of the Queen City, CMC. And now let's talk a little bit about Kansas City. Dr. Stubbs, tell me something we don't know about the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Well, it is in Missouri. Some people get confused with the Kansas City of Missouri split.
It's only our president doesn't know which side of Kansas City.
We, again, it's kind of like Sean said, we are an older and probably used to be a more traditional program, but I do feel like we've evolved a lot over the years as well. We've definitely changed our didactics around a lot. So we have a really pretty robust didactic program now where we do full STEM and small group sessions at least every month or so. Well, at least every month, sometimes more. And we've devoted now our fifth Thursdays to wellness. So usually at least four times a year, we have a full didactic day that's wellness. We do usually either a service project or some sort of group exercise or a combination of both. We've got a wellness champion in our department that's really been instrumental to planning a lot of that. And we've gotten the residents involved. And so that's been, I think, a really positive change for us.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think we take all these really amazing individuals and put them into med school and just take out all of the individualism and, you know, spice of life stuff. So to continue volunteering beyond just putting it on your resume, for instance, you know, and doing it for the right reasons. That's really admirable. Students, UMKC takes care of a big patient population that has a lot of health needs and takes care of them in a very honest and holistic way. And those disparities go away at those hospitals. So definitely check out UMKC. And then the Hoosiers, you know, we know a lot about you guys. I have a lot of old trainees and friends who now work at your health system. So tell me something I don't know about IU.
One of the things at IU that we really focus on for residents is not just their clinical development. I mean, we certainly will focus on that and you're going to be an outstanding clinician after 3 years, but we really want to focus on sort of your development in, as a leader. One of the ways we do that, we really believe in sort of learning by doing. So we actually have a system of resident-run committees and academic tracks. Basically, there's a resident who runs a committee on patient safety, and they help review patient safety reports and kind of get involved hands-on with those types of processes in the hospital. And they essentially, a lot of these resident committees help us run the program. So kind of increases the amount of ownership they have and really helps develop their sort of leadership style and their ability as they're moving out into their careers after that.
Yeah, it's those nice things that come from, I keep saying, the old and storied programs. They've had time to work in a lot of nuance and training. And you guys certainly do that. You're a big health system. You're the only game in town. It's a great place to train. So students, check out Indiana. Michelle, thanks for our close to what I think is season 6. I think when we come back, if you renew us next year, who knows?
I don't know. Touch and go.
We'll see. You'll have to watch the trade papers. Thank you guys for another great annual episode. And students, hang in there.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Emergency Medicine Match Advice. You can view any of our episodes for free on SoundCloud. Also, check out summaries of our episodes as blog posts on Allium.com and in the publication A User's Guide to the Allium EM Match Advice series in the June 2017 issue of the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. We love to hear from our listeners. Post your questions or comments for any of our episodes on Allium.com. Thanks for joining us.